Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
As Presidents Obama and Karzai negotiate the terms of withdrawal of U.S. forces from Afghanistan, and as France intervenes in Mali, where an al-Qaeda-linked extremist group has taken over part of the government, the former commander of U.S. forces in Afghanistan, General Stanley McChrystal, joins us now. He has a new book out called My Share of the Task, a memoir. General McChrystal, I'm so glad you made some time for us. Welcome to WNYC.
Well, Brian, thanks for having me on.
And first off, can we talk about Friday's joint announcement by President Obama and President Karzai that they would accelerate the handover of combat operations from NATO to Afghan forces by this spring rather than summer? And for folks who didn't hear it, that would mean that about 30,000 troops will remain in Afghanistan at the end of the year, U.S. troops. That's down from 66,000 now. And at the end of next year, estimates are that only 3,000 to 9,000 troops will remain, and they would be there mainly in an advise and train capacity. Did the rapidity of that timetable surprise you on Friday, General, and do you approve?
Well, it surprised me a little bit, but I think we really need to look at what's important. The number of U.S. forces in Afghanistan does matter, and their role matters, but I'd leave that up to officers on the ground to judge the impact of that. What's much more important is the Afghan people are frightened about 2014, and they're frightened about the future because they don't want to return to the Taliban. I think what we've really got to do is reassure them that we are a strategic partner, that we are a reliable ally, and whether it's a lot of troops or fewer troops or whether it's a lot of money or less money is less important to them than knowing that we are not going to turn our backs on them as a nation and people.
Well, what would that mean practically if there are only 3,000 to 9,000 troops there after next year?
Well, the number of troops is depending upon what you're trying to do. If you're trying to help them with training at a few bases, maybe doing institution building like logistics or communication, then the numbers can be fairly small. If you're trying to advise out with units in the field, if you're trying to provide medical evacuation support, aircraft, fire support, things like that, then suddenly your numbers go up significantly because you've got to be in more places. And wherever you put Americans, you're going to need to provide them communication support, logistics support, security, and whatnot. So the number is a calculus that goes up pretty rapidly if the mission is more broad than in a narrow training mission.
And can we do that with that few troops, even the narrower mission, considering, for example, the Pentagon report out last month that I'm sure you saw that said just one out of 23 Afghan battalions is capable of operating on its own?
Yeah, I think that's one out of 23 brigades. I think the Afghan army has a lot of challenges still, but has come a long way. And if you look at who they're fighting, the Taliban, I think the Afghan army can actually shoulder the great percentage of this task now. And that's their job. They have to do that. It's their country between the army and the police. But what I do think they need is a partner that provides whatever support is necessary and appropriate.
General Stanley McChrystal, former commander of U.S. forces in Afghanistan, with us on WNYC. So have we won this war? Here's a clip from President Obama from Friday's announcement. And, General, I want you to listen most carefully to the end of this clip.
Have we been able, I think, to shape a strong relationship with a responsible Afghan government that is willing to cooperate with us to make sure that it is not a launching pad for future attacks against the United States? We have achieved that goal. We are in the process of achieving that goal.
So, not a launching pad for future attacks against the United States. Then he said, we have achieved that goal. We're in the process of achieving that goal. Is that contradictory? Is he saying with one breath that we won the war and another breath that we haven't?
I think from watching President Obama and President Karzai that they both view that it is a work still in progress, that the evolution of Afghanistan's ability to defend itself and govern itself effectively is complete, and that America's strategic partnership is committed to helping that. I think that al-Qaeda is certainly weakened in the region and has largely been driven from Afghanistan, and that The concern is to keep the region stable enough so that they can't return.
I want to bring in the Mali question at this point. Very big news there today, obviously. I don't know how familiar you are with Mali, but France has intervened in an effort to block Al-Qaeda-linked Islamist insurgents, and there will be a UN Security Council meeting today to discuss the situation in Mali. Do you see this as analogous to Afghanistan in 2001? That is, if Al-Qaeda actually controls a good part of that country, that it would be used as a safe haven from which to plan and launch attacks against the United States or against Americans abroad?
Sure. I commanded Special Operating Forces from 2003 to 2008. And in my book, I take people through that journey as we went from looking at the problem fairly narrowly to specific locations to having to build a full network to deal with an enemy who was networked, not just inside Iraq or Afghanistan, but they were networked across the region. You need to think about this problem broadly, and you need to have the ability to see it and understand it in each area, because it's a little different in each area, but it also has linkages and similarities. So as we look at a place like Mali, I think it's important to figure out, okay, what allows the rise of extremists in Mali? What is the weakness of the government? How do we certainly don't want to put foreign troops into Mali for an extended period of time like Afghanistan, because you can't afford to do it everywhere. So how do you strengthen the local populace that is not in the extreme to deal with it? I mean, the idea that we are going to do raids and strikes everywhere around the world forever is a losing strategy. It has to be building local capacity.
I think there's a critical view, though, that says what you just described is exactly what the Obama administration and maybe even Bush before him has been trying to do in Mali, which is to strengthen the local forces there and the conditions on the ground. But that didn't work because the Islamists did stage this successful coup. And now France, of all countries, is having to go in with direct military intervention and pick up the pieces. Is that the wrong way to look at it?
No, I don't think it's wrong, but just because something's hard doesn't mean it shouldn't be what you do. I mean, sometimes people deal with something like Afghanistan or Mali and they go, wow, if we do this, it's going to be very difficult, or it has been difficult and we get frustrated. Doesn't mean you're doing the wrong thing. It just means it's hard.
Should the U.S. intervene in Mali or back up France with anything explicit in terms of troops or weaponry?
I'm not prepared to say we should intervene at this point. I think assisting our allies when they do specific operations makes great sense. I think crafting our policy to go ahead to try to increase the ability of Mali to protect its own sovereignty, particularly from a threat like internal Islamic extremism, makes a lot of sense.
My guest on WNYC is General Stanley McChrystal, who was commander of U.S. forces in Afghanistan. He has a new book out called My Share of the Task, a memoir. And General McChrystal, you're credited with creating the super targeted lethal strike model of warfare from when you were in Iraq. You remade or participated in remaking the Pentagon's Joint Special Operations Command that successfully killed Zarqawi, for example. How do you think that focus on special forces has changed military strategy going forward when we look at Afghanistan or Mali or anything having to do with Al-Qaeda?
I think most importantly, what we learned is information is everything. I tell people now that the future of warfare is going to be whoever knows the most and knows it quickest is going to win. It's not going to be mass. And special forces, particularly the task force that I was able to be a part of, we went through this tremendous transformation, and we became about 80% focused on intelligence and 20% focused on operations. Now, we were doing up to 300 raids a month, but where before we gathered intelligence to do raids, over time we learned, because knowledge is the ultimate goal, to do operations, to gather information. And we developed an entire, very refined network to pull in intelligence, process it quickly, disseminate it out across this extensive network that we had, and then be able to act on it. Then we needed to be more decentralized in our execution, yet we had to have this shared consciousness across the overall formation. It was a stunning transformation to be a part of, and I think it is representative of the future of war.
Does that suggest that the entire model of the Afghanistan war was ill-conceived, going in and knocking out the Taliban government and, in effect, occupying the country and trying to get them to rebuild, rather than doing these more targeted strikes from the beginning?
No, it doesn't mean that at all. We did these targeted strikes in Iraq for several years before an effective counterinsurgency campaign was conducted in parallel to it. You can do strikes forever, but you've got to build as you operate. You've got to be able to develop local capacity. All you're doing is what we call playing whack-a-mole. Those two have got to be complementary. But at the same time, the focus on knowledge, what we didn't do well enough in Afghanistan early was understand. We didn't study it enough. We didn't speak the language enough. We didn't learn the language enough. We didn't understand the personalities of the forces at play. So we sort of violated the idea that he who knows the most is going to be most effective. We got better over time, but we under-resourced that war for a number of years. So we created some of the problems that we've had to deal with in the last few years, but Afghanistan was going to be hard no matter what we did.
Plan counterinsurgency and plan whack-a-mole. you've got, I guess when you say counterinsurgency, you refer to the David Petraeus troop surge in the Iraq war after 2006. There's an emerging conventional wisdom that says the Petraeus surge worked in Iraq, failed in Afghanistan. Is that your position?
No. Here's the first part, that the surge in Iraq was part of what changed the dynamic. The first part of changed is we had been putting pressure on the Sunni insurgents, and about the end of 2006, they were coming to a conclusion that we were not their biggest threat, but instead the Shia were, and that they couldn't beat us anyway. So there started to be a Sunni awakening. The arrival of the additional surge forces and a retooled strategy to get them out to places where they could hold terrain and actually protect Iraqi people, I think all of those things and some other factors went together to make that effective. In Afghanistan, the purpose of the surge was similar, but when we asked for that in the fall of 2009, the situation was deteriorating so rapidly and the confidence of the Afghan people dropping so precipitously that we had to control parts of the country, both to stem Taliban momentum and to renew Afghan confidence. That was to give us a bridge of time to develop Afghan army and police forces and other capacities. So I think that as you see increased security in places like Helmand and Kandahar, which is significantly better than it was in 2009 and 2010, the surge in Afghanistan has worked. The problem is it's incomplete. The surge was only designed to give you that gap, to cover that gap, and to give you an opportunity to mature Afghan capability. That is incomplete at this point. That needs to be continued.
Did President Obama give you too few troops for the surge in Afghanistan? Some people say he ordered too many troops to satisfy the left wing of the Democratic Party, but too few troops to actually accomplish the goal.
No, I don't think so. We asked for 40,000 troops. He gave us 30,000 Americans and pressed NATO ISAF partners to give the other 10,000. I don't think all of that other 10,000 materialized, but I don't know the exact number. So generally, he in fact did resource to the level that we requested.
Did President Obama ever tie your hands with restrictive rules of engagement because he was too cautious about civilian deaths? A good concern to have, obviously. But did it prevent us from winning the war in a clearer way ever?
No. In fact, I never got pressure or guidance on that. I made the decision to sharply control the use of fires, and I did it for a very practical reason. If we didn't stop killing Afghan civilians, if we couldn't convince the Afghan people that we were there to protect them, we were going to lose. It was less compassion than clear-eyed practicality. We need the support of the Afghan people to be successful in Afghanistan. And every time they saw a civilian casualty incident or something, it eroded very dramatically, and the Taliban were leveraging that. I think our efforts to bring that down were very, very instrumental in getting additional Afghan support. Now, again, Afghanistan remains hard, but I think that remains a key part of how NATO ISAF forces have to operate.
General, how about armed unmanned drones in that regard? They're obviously designed to be precise and kill individual terrorists and terrorist leaders without doing a lot of destruction to the country, but civilians do die in some of these strikes, and it seems like that's the reputation that the drones are getting. Big risk to civilians, and so they're ethically, morally controversial around the world now. What's your position?
I think they are much more controversial than many Americans realize. They are a key tool for reconnaissance and strike for America, and I'm a big supporter of them. But we need to understand modern wars are not like World War II, where we crush our enemy and then we have rebuild. Wars are won in the minds of people. They decide who the victor and the loser is. And so every time we conduct an operation of any kind, how it's perceived by people, whether it's people near the strike or far away, is really key. We need to look at the reaction in places like Pakistan, the incredible concern that the Pakistani population has over violations of sovereignty and whatnot. And we need to weigh every action we take, like drone strikes, against the cost, because each has a value and each has a cost.
Is there a guideline? How do you decide in an individual case whether to pull the trigger on a drone strike?
In my view, you've got to do really a risk versus gain. First, you've got to make sure that what you're shooting at is a valid target, legal, all the common sense things any of us would do. But you've also got to decide what's the effect going to be, not just on who you're shooting, but on everybody who perceives it, because that perception matters. Sometimes it's the right thing to strike, sometimes it's not, but it's got to be a very mature process.
Does it ever bother you that a guy could sit in the comfort of an office in Utah or somewhere and push a button that launches a drone strike in Afghanistan or Pakistan?
Well, it concerns me from the standpoint it might be too easy to feel like you are actually at war. It might be too easy to forget that the explosion you see on a screen is explosion and shrapnel and death on the ground. I used to talk to people about when President Clinton ordered the 1998 Tomahawk strikes into Pakistan and Sudan after al-Qaeda targets, if you'd asked Americans the next morning whether America was at war, most Americans probably would have said, no, we shot some Tomahawks, but we're not at war. But if you were at the receiving end of those Tomahawks, your view would be different. And we need to understand that what we do in the world is viewed differently. Does it mean sometimes it's not right to do, but it means we never want to be cavalier about something just because there's no direct risk to us at the time.
Important observation. I appreciate your time. I know you got to go in a minute. Last question. We did a series last year called The End of War, and the central question of that series was, is war inevitable? It's the ultimate question. Or can humanity ever end war once and for all? Have you ever considered that question directly?
I've actually thought about it a lot, and I know that in 1989 we said the end of history, and there was an idea that powers could make the use of force so difficult that it would stop it. I don't see that now. I'd love to see it. I think places, it still works for people to use power so that they can go after whatever their interest is. Until we can make it so that it doesn't work, you can't get your ends, it won't go away, and that's unfortunate.
Former commander of U.S. forces in Afghanistan, General Stanley McChrystal. His new memoir is My Share of the Task, a memoir. By the way, what's next for you? Politics, maybe?
No, sir. I am teaching at Yale, and I have co-founded a leadership consulting company that works with big non-defense firms.
Thank you, General.
Thank you, sir.
Brian Lehrer and WNYC. Coming up next, we may be debating Sandy relief, but this weekend was the third anniversary of the earthquake in Haiti, which that country has still not recovered from. We'll talk to two Haiti experts about the mixed blessing of international aid, and then we will dip into President Obama's news conference, which is going to start very soon.